KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Chance of rain and snow this evening, then snow and rain likely overnight, the low in the mid-30s.
When I wake up in my room and I saw the fire, I knew that I was going to die, that this was the end of my story.
Sitting in traffic, believe it or not, could actually become a restful experience if you're not stressing yourself out about it.
What is the foundation of moral citizenship? How do we learn together from the past to build a new and creative and fulfilling future?
That was our guest who's coming up to talk about how slave labor was used to build the Smithsonian. We're going to find out more about that. We're going to talk about stress and how to deal with it this time of year. And you heard the voices of one of our radioactive high school producers. We're going to talk about that program and try to recruit some more high school students. You can help us. But we're going to start with the question of the fiscal cliff. How are those negotiations going? Cliff, slope, step. In a private meeting this morning, House Speaker John Boehner said the House will consider a plan B since the White House talks aren't moving fast enough. Jill Jackson is the Capitol Hill producer for CBS News. Jill, can you get plan B in Washington, D.C. pharmacies?
I know. You know, that was exactly what I was thinking when I saw the email this morning that that's what they were talking about.
what is Speaker Boehner talking about when he says plan B?
Well, essentially, the Speaker and the President are still negotiating a deal to avert the fiscal cliff January 1st. But what Speaker Boehner told his members this morning in a closed-door meeting was that he wants to bring forward and start working on a plan B. You know, every poll out, including a CBS News poll out today, shows that the Republicans would be blamed if we go over the fiscal cliff and Americans see their taxes go up come January 1st. And basically, he told his members, look, everybody's taxes are going to go up. We need to do something to act and show Americans that we don't want those taxes to go up. So the plan B essentially would be a package that would allow the Bush tax cuts to expire for those making over $1 million a year. So the very wealthiest in our country would pay a higher tax rate. It would go from 35% to 39.6%. That reflects the latest offer from Speaker John Boehner to the President. The President originally wanted the threshold to be $250,000, and in his latest offer to Speaker Boehner, raised it to $400,000. So clearly the two sides are still far apart on that. But essentially, the package would just extend the rates for all Americans up to $1 million, and then basically the sequester, we would not deal with the sequester because the House has already passed a bill that would replace those cuts. And it may deal with things like the estate tax and a couple other big ticket items. But at the moment, the package itself is still being crafted, so we're not exactly sure.
Is the plan B in any way supposed to appeal to Democrats or the administration?
Well, in some ways it calls Democrats out who in the past have said that we should consider extending the Bush tax cuts for those making up to $1 million a year. Those Democrats would include former Speaker Nancy Pelosi. It would include Senator Chuck Schumer. And they've come out. Originally, it was Senator Chuck Schumer who said that should be the plan. However, Democrats say the election changed things, that the president went out on the stump and sold raising taxes on Americans making over $250,000 a year, and was reelected with the mandate to essentially get that plan. And they say the president has made significant concessions by being willing to even go up to the $400,000.
What reaction have you heard about that concession this morning from other House members, Republican and Democrat?
Well, one House Republican, conservative from Idaho, Raul Labrador, came out and just immediately told me this is a terrible idea and I won't vote for it. But then others came out. You had Congressman Jeff Flake, who's going to be the future senator of Arizona next year, Congressman Steve LaTourette, many folks coming out and saying, you know, this shows that Republicans are resigned to allowing some tax rates to expire. Some tax rates to go up on the wealthiest Americans. So they said that the conference is becoming more united on that than they certainly were 2 weeks ago, which is an interesting sign. But a lot of members seem kind of confused about where things are going. The fact that they'll be moving forward on this at the same time that Boehner is continuing his discussions with the president. Majority Leader Eric Cantor said that this Plan B could come to the floor as early as Thursday, but there's a lot of time between now and Thursday in terms of negotiations with the president. So we'll see if this even actually comes to the floor.
So the Plan B is sort of calling the bluff isn't right, but I guess that's what you said, calling their bluff. But it's sort of laying down their marker at this point before the holiday.
Right. But I will say immediately, Majority Leader Harry Reid in the Senate came out and said that this package could not pass the Senate. And the president's press secretary, Jay Carney, also rejected it, saying it is not a balanced approach. But he's hopeful that a deal still can be reached.
Jill Jackson is the Capitol Hill producer for CBS News. She is covering this issue personal for you, right, Jill? If they stay there, you're not coming back to Seattle and coming home.
That's right. I would love to be on your side of the country for the holidays, see some of my family who live there. But if Congress is here between Christmas and New Year's, I will be here too and ready to give you all updates.
All right, we're rooting for you. So in terms of the concessions the Obama administration has made in the last couple of days, some of them seem like big deals, the $250,000 to $400,000, and also the agreement to allow allow Social Security to be indexed, the inflation to be indexed differently.
That's right. These are big deals because members of his own party have rejected changing the inflation calculation that determines what your cost of living adjustment will be for Social Security. But the president, this is one thing that Speaker Boehner's office said has held up negotiations, though, is that in the White House's latest offer, while he made that concession, he also said that he wants some enhanced benefits for the extremely elderly and the disabled who are on Social Security. So that was sort of a surprise to Republicans who say they're not necessarily against it. It just kind of blindsided them. The taxes was a major concession, $400,000. Clearly, that's not enough for the Republicans. And then the fact that the White House says that they've matched dollar for dollar spending cuts to revenue, and that meets the speaker's demand that this package be balanced between taxes and spending cuts. But, of course, the speaker's office denied that as well, saying that if you look at net spending cuts, because the president is still demanding an extension of unemployment insurance and an extension some added infrastructure spending, that if you take that spending into account, you have really $850 billion in spending cuts and $1.3 trillion in tax revenues. So they say that's not balanced. So while clearly the White House has made concessions, I don't feel that the speaker thinks it's enough that he can convince his conference to go along at this point.
So those guys aren't going to be coming home for the holidays either unless something changes, will they?
Exactly. I mean, the thinking is that the talk behind the scenes when everyone really gets down to the schedule is it's likely that, Congress would take Christmas Eve and Christmas Day off, but then they'd be right back here between Christmas and New Year's to try and work something out, because neither side actually, at least at the leader level, they do not at this point want to go over the cliff.
Does it feel they don't? They don't feel they want to go over the cliff. Does it still feel like a cliff, or are some members talking about, it's not a cliff, it's a slope, it's a step. We can deal with January 1st and January 15th.
There are some members, but I can tell you that they're really kind of outliers. And they tend to be on the most extreme end of both parties, which is kind of interesting. I think both folks think that they will have a strong, both the liberal Democrats and very, very conservative Republicans feel like they'll have a stronger hand come January. The Republicans will really be able to force the debt limit issue. The Democrats say that, since tax rates will have expired for everyone, all everyone will be voting for is a tax increase, so that makes it politically more palatable. So there is that discussion. That being said, I do not believe that leaders are showing any sign that they're ready to do that.
Tax break. They'll be able to vote for tax breaks after January 1st. They won't have
right.
to. They won't be voting for tax increases. So,
right.
All right. So, given that, and given that sort of sensibility, play poker with me for a minute here. Maybe it's not poker. Maybe it's a little poker. It's a little roulette, since we don't really know. What does it feel like right now there in terms of decision?
The reality is, I think that there are two things going on. You have what's happening behind the scenes, and the fact is we've seen tremendous progress in negotiations since Friday, when Speaker Boehner called the president after the Newtown shooting and finally gave in on tax, on allowing some tax rates to go up. That was a major concession for the Republicans. Since then, we've seen very specific proposals exchange hands between the Republicans and the White House, very specific numbers, concessions on both sides, and they neither side is saying they're walking away from the table, and that will continue. And if you do kind of a side-by-side and see sort of the two packages, they're just quite similar. Doesn't look like there's that much farther to go except for maybe some spending cuts here. Maybe they tweak the revenue numbers a little bit here, maybe drop the infrastructure spending that the White House is demanding. You know, these are the sorts of things that they're considering. But then we have what's going on in public with this new Plan B. And there's a part of me that wonders if they are just trying to show a public fight, because Republicans are going to be making serious concessions in this since President Obama won the election. And they need to look like they didn't just roll over and take what the president proposed. If they gave up and announced a deal today, a lot of Republicans would say that Speaker John Boehner caved too soon, that he did not stick to Republican principles, whereas if you take them a little closer to Christmas, a little closer, you know, maybe possibly even to New Year's, it looks like Republicans gave the good fight, and they would have fought the good fight. So I think that you have a little bit of a public appearances issue going on as well.
I see. And on the administration side, the president, though he campaigned on $250,000 as his limit, he doesn't look like he's caving to start it at $400,000 or higher.
I think at this point that's something that I have not heard any powerful Democrat in leadership yet rule that out, honestly, or come out criticizing the president for it. Though again, some liberals will criticize that for sure. But at this point, it's been quite silent.
And Jill, you mentioned the Connecticut shootings. I imagine we know that washed over the Washington, D.C., and it brought out proclamations and statements. Mm-hmm. But in the end, does it really affect budget negotiations?
You know, I think it changes the tone a little bit. I think everyone wants to look like grown-ups. They don't want to look like they're fighting in a spiteful manner or inappropriately. I think that it's elevated sort of the way that the two sides are speaking to one another. But in terms of the nitty-gritty details, I don't think it will have that much impact. I will say that a conversation has been starting in an informal way among members as to what Congress's proper response to this should be. They did pass a resolution condemning it last night, but that doesn't do much other than it's for appearances, and it may serve some emotional purpose. But we have heard in the conference meeting this morning, we saw members coming out saying that, yeah, you know, maybe we would consider some changes to at least limit the amount of ammunition one can buy or what kind of magazines you can buy, and maybe mental health background checks need to be strengthened. You know, there's a real conversation going. That being said, Congressman Steve LaTourette from Ohio told me that he thinks that we really won't know if Congress is going to have a response this time after not responding to the other shootings over the past 4 years. We won't really know until some time has passed. We'll see if the pressure to act stays and if the you know, momentum that we feel right now, if that continues or if it dies down as it has after the Aurora shooting and even after their own colleague Gabrielle Giffords was shot in the head.
Yeah. All right, Jill Jackson, Capitol Hill producer for CBS News. I appreciate you taking the time, and I hope you get home for the holidays and we avert the fiscal cliff.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you. Jill Jackson is Capitol Hill producer for CBS News. And as you heard, she used to live in our area. By the way, we're going to ask the question about just how far people might be willing to go. After 10 o'clock, Bruce Harrell is talking about getting the state legislature to enact some changes in our gun control laws. We're also going to talk to someone who's been opposed to changes in gun control laws, the executive director of the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. We'll see if he's also talking concession. This is Weekday.
According to new research, the Smithsonian Castle in Washington, D.C. was built with sandstone quarried by slaves. The castle joins the Capitol building and the White House on the list of important American buildings built with slave labor. We'll find out more coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from Earth Justice, a nonprofit law firm that believes a healthy environment is a fundamental right, working to protect the waters of Puget Sound and the native salmon and orca that live there. Earth Justice, the earth needs a good lawyer.
Hi, this is Robert Siegel of NPR News. When you make your tax-deductible donations at the end of the year, please consider donating to KUOW. The news and information you rely on all year long is made possible by listeners who value public radio as an independent news source, value it, and support it. So please mail your donation today or go online at KUOW.org. Thank you.
We have cloudy skies and 39 degrees in the U District. Chance of snow this morning, changing to a chance of rain and snow this afternoon, the high in the upper 30s. It's going to be cloudy and windy tonight, chance of rain and snow, the low in the mid 30s. It's 9:20.
The Capitol and the White House were built with slave labor. And now the Smithsonian Castle joins that list. Mark Auslander is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Museum Studies at Central Washington University. Professor Auslander, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here, Steve.
When did you find out that the Smithsonian Castle had also used slave labor?
Well, I'd always heard the rumor. I mean, even in college, I used to work in the castle as an intern at the Wilson Quarterly, and I'd always heard from elderly African-American guards that there was a long history of slave labor at the castle. That had not been taken seriously by professional historians, but then 2 years ago when I was back doing a research project on another topic, I came across an amazing series of documents that led me back to the Seneca Quarry about 25 miles just up the Potomac River, up the C&O Canal from Washington, D.C. And that's where the Triassic sandstone was quarried in 1847 and 1848. And got some lucky breaks, and that revealed not only that there had been slaves working in this quarry, but the names of those enslaved people, and the fact that they had come off of the Martha Custis Washington estate, that is to say, out at Mount Vernon, where of course George Washington lived with Martha. So it's a very interesting, unexpected twist in the early American story.
That is. So they were slaves that were owned by Martha Custis Washington or her family at this point?
They had been. That's right. After, through a complicated legal story, they had been, these various enslaved families had been transferred first to Georgetown into the family of Martha Washington's granddaughter, and then her great-grandson acquired them. Many of the Mount Vernon families, and brought them out to this place called Seneca, where they worked in slavery.
Mark Auslander is also the author of The Accidental Slave Owner, Revisiting a Myth of the American South, for which we talked to him about that. So these were people who did the dangerous work of quarrying. Unlike the Capitol and the White House, the Smithsonian Castle was not built by slave labor?
No, there's every reason to think that actually there were enslaved people involved in building the castle as well. We just don't have the documents on that. The one thing that we do have very strong document evidence on that tells us the names is about the quarry. But given the nature of the labor market in Washington, D.C. in that period before the Civil War, it's almost certain that they were enslaved people working on different parts of the building. We have a few hints on that, but the thing is, the Smithsonian's records mainly burned in January 1865, near the end of the Civil War. So we have a number of gaps in our knowledge. But we can guess from some other sources that seem to have been enslaved people planting the trees and working on the pipes and things like that, and probably in the construction. We just don't have direct evidence of that.
Now, where did you, since the records burned, what were the crumbs that you followed? What were those records?
Well, there were a few lucky things. Congress had actually had a building committee, and so there were records on the negotiations that they did with John Park Custis Peter, who was Martha Washington's great-grandson, on getting that sandstone. He could offer a really good price. One of the reasons he could offer a good price, it would seem, is that and could underbid everybody else, is that he didn't have to worry about labor costs. He had a group of enslaved people working for him. So those documents helped. Finding the identities, had to get out of the Smithsonian records and head over to Montgomery County, Maryland. It turns out that the next year, in 1848, John Peter died without a will, and that actually helps historians sometimes because the court had to order an inventory of all his property to make sure his children and heirs were looked after. And going through those old records, I first found a list of the animals he'd owned and the furniture and things like that, then turned the page, and there was the name of about 24 enslaved people, their names and their ages. And that really was an amazing feeling, really gave me chills, having worked and studied the history of the Smithsonian for so long, to actually see the names of those enslaved people that had worked in the quarry and quarried that famous red sandstone that we're all familiar with on the Smithsonian's oldest building.
I note also in some of the coverage that you said that you had you'd gone to Seneca and you talked to some people who lived near the old quarry site.
Yeah, that was the amazing thing. So after I found all this and found the names and this history, I did head out there. I was exploring the quarry, which is a beautiful site. And then it was Sunday morning, and I headed up to a worship service at Seneca Community Church, which is the old African-American church. And before I could tell people what I was interested in, they heard I was working at the Smithsonian, that I was a senior fellow there. And they started to laugh and said, "Oh, the Smithsonian, we've been waiting for you." And they'd passed down the story for 170 years. They knew it. So in a sense, I wasn't telling the community anything they didn't know, but they were very pleased that they were now historical documents, court documents, legal documents, financial documents that supported the story that had always been passed down by their foremothers and forefathers.
It wasn't just oral history anymore. Now it was written history. Now you've codified it.
Exactly. And I think that's some of the most exciting work we can do in public history or public anthropology is when we understand that there are different ways of knowing the past, and we can actually coordinate the oral history and the written documents.
The Smithsonian was built between 1847 and 1855. Did he make good money on it because he had slaves to do the work rather than having to pay people wages?
Right. He certainly, the family did all right. He died, actually, of lockjaw, of tetanus, just before the first money came in, so he didn't get to enjoy it. It did help the estate somewhat. They weren't particularly wealthy by the standards of say, the great Virginia slave planters, but they did all right. None of that money, though, none of that compensation went down to the enslaved people, by the way. So those families... We're still trying to trace some of them. We have some hints of what happened to them during and after the Civil War, but obviously no money was ever passed down to them.
Is that right? Some hints. What are some of the hints telling you?
Well, two of them show up as free, actually in 1850, just a couple years after the Smithsonian Project started. The rest seem to be taken into Virginia. John Peter's widow quickly remarried a Presbyterian minister who was very pro-Southern, so moved them over into the South, and he became a courier, a messenger for Confederate forces, got arrested by the Union forces for a while, and then got ransomed back, traded back. But he kept his slaves and distributed the rest of them to the rest of those slaves to his widow's children. So they were spread around Virginia. Some of them seem to have made their way back into Montgomery County, though, back in Maryland after the Civil War. So we're trying to trace. The same sort of thing I did with the accidental slave owner. It would be wonderful from the Smithsonian standpoint to be able to locate those living descendant families that go all the way back to slavery and invite them down to visit the castle and see the Smithsonian museums and reflect on how we're all bound together as a great American family in these stories of labor and work that we sometimes forget about, but that cut across lines of race.
Mark Auslander is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Museum Studies at Central Washington University. He has traced the information and found the documents that show that the Smithsonian Castle was built by sandstone quarried by slaves. As well, it joins the Capitol and the White House on the list of important American buildings built with slave labor. So beyond that great coming together and understanding, Mark Auslander, what does it mean to you? How do the buildings feel when you walk in them? And what should the rest of us remember, knowing that these buildings were part of America's slave legacy and history?
Yeah, I think it's just important to remember that all of these great American icons, whether or not they're the Capitol, the White House, or the Smithsonian Castle, or so many other buildings, take us back to our very complex history. Our history has always been diverse and multiracial, and the story of slavery is one we can't really get away from. And it's not a story we should shy from. We should face right up to those contradictions and some of that historical pain, but also think that that enables us to move forward. Since the Washington Post wrote an article on this, and I've been getting beautiful letters from all over the country from people who have worked at the Smithsonian of many different backgrounds, who are very moved to know of these connections and to have the names. You know, when we move beyond just the statistics that 4 million people were held in slavery at the start of the Civil War, to when we get to a place where we're not just talking about numbers, we're talking about real-life names, real-life family connections, that does something to us. And I think that's what we need. What we've seen with Connecticut, of course, it's not just the numbers, of course, but it's the individual names when there's a tragic loss. And that's what binds us together as a community, when we can honor people's names and family stories in the time of some greatest suffering. That is what binds us together. And in the same way, I think, when we go back in the history of our nation, when we can recover the names that are long lost and remember that we are all, in a sense, distant cousins to one another, and when those buildings, especially of a great scientific institution, one of the world's greatest museum complexes, when that holds up a mirror to who we are, it does hold up a mirror not only to tragic loss, but also to our better natures, the angels of our better nature. And I guess that's what it means for me as somebody who works works at the Smithsonian sometimes and loves it as an institution, to remember all that history.
Well, I like that notion of the angels of our better nature. That'll make it somewhat positive. I appreciate that. Mark Auslander, thanks a lot.
Great. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Mark Auslander is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Museum Studies at Central Washington University. He's also the author of The Accidental Slave Owner. He tells us about the Smithsonian Castle having been built with sandstone quarried by slaves. Proof of that, probably there'll be proof at some point that the buildings themselves were built partially at least with slave labor, as was the Capitol and the White House. This is Weekday. As were the Capitol and the White House, just to get my tenses right. December can be a stressful time for people. But in reality, at least according to the American Psychological Association, 70% of us experience physical symptoms from stress on a regular basis. I can attest to that.
Right.
Katie Sewell's here. Can you attest to that?
Yeah, and I'm totally stressed out. No, I'm not. I'm not stressed out. But I was thinking about stress because at this time of year, so many of us are running around like crazy and being stuck in traffic a little more frequently. And it's 77% of us suffering from symptoms of stress, like muscle aches, fatigue, and not only that, emotional problems where we might be more willing to cry or get angry more frequently. So if 77% of us are experiencing stress on a regular basis, I wanted to know how to let that go, because that seems too high. So I talked to Jillian Murrah, who's a psychotherapist in private practice since 1980. She says that there are two types of stress that affect us. One is the kind we have no control over, like sitting in traffic, but a lot of it is self-induced. And I asked her to explain the difference.
Well, self-induced stress is something like you need to leave the house in 5 minutes and you cram in one more thing when you really don't have time. And then you're tense and rushed on the other end trying to get somewhere on time. A lot of our stress is unnecessary. And so if we got more mindful, if we became more aware of what we're doing, what our choices are, what we're thinking, we'd be a lot more peaceful.
Why do you think that Americans schedule themselves so heavily?
To avoid their vulnerability.
And why are we, as a culture, people that want to avoid our vulnerability?
I think a lot of it has to do with because we haven't always been very supported when we're vulnerable. People often try to talk you out of feeling whatever you're feeling. How often do you see someone just have a good cry on the street corner or in the workplace or in the grocery store? That's would be considered embarrassing. Well, it would be so healthy if we could do that. Not to make a big scene, but just to be authentic in that moment and express yourself.
So if there are stresses that we have no control over, How are we supposed to deal with those types of stressful mm-hmm. situations?
Well, for instance, I'm thinking about the traffic jam. And in life, if we look at something and say, is there anything I can do about this situation? Like, could I schedule my life differently so I'm not driving at peak hours? Could I take a bus? Things like that. Could I do something differently? So number one, can I change the situation? Number two would be, can I get away from this? Like, can I get off that exit beforehand? Because I know there's usually going to be a traffic jam down the way. Or third, if we can't do anything about the situation or get away from it, the third, and I think most powerful, is to surrender to it, to accept it. So one way to deal a lot with that, accepting what is and stress, is to get very present and quiet as you can in your body. So that means noticing your body. A lot of us are spending our times in our head, literally from the shoulders up, which is why so many people have tight shoulders. We're so in our heads and thinking a lot, and we're not aware of our deep presence in our being. So sitting in traffic, believe it or not, could actually become a restful experience if you're not stressing yourself out about it.
If somebody's listening right now and they actually are stuck in traffic, what analysis should they do?
Intentionally drop your awareness down into your body and notice your body, whatever it is. You don't have to change anything in your body, but you might notice, oh yeah, my hands are in a fist, I'm so mad, they're tight, or my belly's hurting because I'm so upset and scared. Or my feet are, can I feel my feet? Let me notice, can I even find my feet? Can I get that aware? Mm-hmm. How's my back feel? Just tracking yourself. And breath, just breath awareness. Those things help a lot.
Does it take a lot of practice to kick into that?
It does take practice. It's something that I think children do by nature and need to be supported in, so we do it the rest of our lives.
I'm speaking with Jillian Mara. She's a psychotherapist who's been in private practice since 1980, working in Seattle and on Whidbey Island. What does your emotional health have to do with stress?
If we are very stressed, we don't feel emotionally well. And I think a lot of this has to do with self-criticism. If we're getting down on ourselves, then we'll often feel emotionally distressed.
Is there an easy way for a person to identify that they're not an emotionally healthy person?
Are you peaceful? Are you sleeping well? Do you have a good relationship with food? How much are you using mood-altering substances, cigarettes or marijuana or alcohol or sugars, a lot of things, to shift how you're feeling, to go into avoidance? We have emotions all the time. Any moment in time, if you notice yourself and check in with your body and ask yourself, what am I feeling emotionally right now? There is an emotion there. It takes the willingness, I think, and the structure in your life to pay attention.
When you read about stress, they do say it's good for you to have a glass of wine at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's true?
Well, I think a glass of wine for some people is fine. However, I don't use wine to relax. You can relax without wine. Mm-hmm. You can relax through having a good walk, through getting out of your head, to bracketing, what I call putting a bracket around all those thoughts sometimes that aren't really that important and nothing you can do about it in the moment anyway. You could meditate, learn to meditate. Just sit and watch the clouds for a while. Just a few minutes of that will be soothing. Get out in nature more.
So if a person listening suspects that maybe they're not the most emotionally healthy person, mm-hmm. what should they be doing?
Well, I would think just being willing to notice. And notice what you're feeling and notice what you're thinking, because the thoughts will create an emotional response. If you go, oh, I'm not a healthy emotional person, and what a loser, I'm 45 and I'm still not emotionally healthy, well, then you're going to feel even less emotionally healthy. You're going to feel poorly about yourself. So, but if you could reframe negative thoughts, and a lot of us tell stories, we make up these stories about ourselves in life, as opposed to reframing that and going, oh, boy, I'm not aware of my emotions, am I? And I'm going to start to pay attention.
You're touching on an interesting thing there, because a lot of us do live in our heads most mm-hmm. of the time. In fact, probably everybody. Mm-hmm. You go out on the street, everyone's walking around. It looks like, no, they're just creatures wandering around like mm-hmm. pigeons, you know. But in our heads, there's lots of stories, there's lots of observations yeah. going on. How do you silence that in your daily life, or do you need to?
You know, one way to silence it, too, is to get support, to talk to other people. We are so in need of connection. It's a core basic need of humans. The first thing we need when we're born is, or even prenatally, is connection. And so to talk with other people, sometimes getting counseling if you're really lost with this. But it's so important. We're not whole beings otherwise. We're just in our heads, and we start making up those stories about what it means to be successful. And we drive ourselves and push ourselves and hurry ourselves. And you end up having things like headaches and backaches and stomach aches and high blood pressure and all kinds of unnecessary experiences.
I'm speaking with Jillian Murrah. She's a psychotherapist who's been in private practice since 1980, working in Seattle and on Whidbey Island. What should somebody listening do to reduce their stress today?
They should sit still for 5 minutes, notice their breathing.
That's it.
It could be that simple.
And maybe drop one of those extracurricular activities.
Indeed. Do less, be more balanced.
Do you think it's possible to maintain a stress-free lifestyle?
I actually do. I have that hope. I think it's possible. I'm thinking when I'm stressed now, it's usually because I'm not fully allowing something. I'm resisting. If we resist something, that's automatic tension. So I work regularly to allow.
Jillian Murrah, psychotherapist in private practice since 1980. Thanks for coming in.
You're very welcome.
We have cloudy skies and 39 degrees in the U District. Chance of snow this morning, becoming a chance of rain and snow later today, the high in the upper 30s. It's going to be cloudy and windy tonight, chance of rain and snow, the low in the mid 30s, cloudy, rainy, and windy tomorrow, and a little warmer, tomorrow's high reaching 41.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Children's, where doctors and nurses provided more than $103 million in uncompensated care to children and families in the region last year, thanks to a generous community. Information at seattlechildrens.org.
There was a time not all that long ago that Michigan was the heart of the American labor movement. But you know what? Times change.
If the plant's gone, there's not much use in the union hall.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Unions in Michigan today and how they got to where they are. That story next time on Marketplace. The numbers from Wall Street as well. It's from APM.
That story and more coming up tonight at 6:30.
Support for KUOW comes from Puget Sound Energy with a reminder that Energy Star refrigerators and freezers use less energy but have all the same features as standard models. More information is available at pse.com/appliances.
Radioactive is KUOW's youth radio program. It evolved out of Weekday High. You may remember that. Now it is a year-round program, and Jenny Asarno, who was a weekday producer, is now running the program. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Now, we have because it's year-round, we have another session coming up.
We do.
February 12th to April 11th, Tuesdays and Thursdays, and you're not meeting in the station necessarily.
No, we're holding each of our after-school workshops at a different location around Seattle in different neighborhoods. So this one is going to be at the 2100 building, which is where Treehouse is in Rainier Valley. It's right near Franklin High School. And we're holding the workshop in partnership with Rainier Scholars.
And that's the other expansion. We're reaching out, and we're doing it in partnership with nonprofits in order to just broaden our base and reach more of different communities.
Exactly, yeah. Make it easier for teenagers who don't live near the U District to get there.
And make it easier for teenagers who want to work in radio to find a way to work in radio. Because, as you were saying, who knows what happens with that program? Amina Alsade, who was working with us as our third producer, she came through that program 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, and we've had other people go through the program and end up in TV or working for online outlets. And you certainly don't need to know that you want to have a career in journalism to go through the program. But if it is something that you're interested in, it's a really great opportunity. It's also just fun for someone who wants to give it a shot to make their own radio stories and learn how to write a different way, do storytelling in a different way.
It is fun. It is great. So you brought in a few examples to entice you or your children, if you are not one of those children, to maybe think about this program. You brought in a few stories, listen to a few clips from stories.
Yeah, I wanted to share a few clips from stories that were produced by students in our after-school workshop this fall, which we held at the South Park Community Center. And six students participated in the workshop. It was a lot of fun. They did all their own interviewing, all their own recording, all their own audio editing. They did everything themselves, and they produced stories that are really close to their hearts. I'm going to share just a few clips from those. This first story is about one of the radioactive youth producers, Dulce Saucedo. This past summer, she fell asleep with candles lit in her bedroom and woke up with her room engulfed in a fire. And her leg was burned, but otherwise she was okay. Nobody else was hurt, but her family lost their home and she lost everything that she owned. And she created a meditation about her experience. We're going to listen to a clip.
When I wake up in my room and I saw the fire, I knew that I was going to die, that this was the end of my story. The next thing, I saw my brother come in to save me. He grabbed my arm and said, "Let's go." When I saw my brother coming up the stairs, I didn't know that he cared that much to come and save me. He would always tell me he hated me, that he wishes I was dead.
All your life, you told me you hated me. You said you wanted me dead. You said you wanted me gone. Why did you run and save me?
Well, I didn't want to lose you because I thought that we really get along sometimes, but we get mad at each other for some reasons, and sometimes I start it, sometimes you take it too far, and I just didn't want to lose those memories, and all the laughs and funs that we had, so that's why I ran up there to get you.
I asked my brother how did he feel when he found out that I was okay, but knowing my brother, he's not going to like talking about his feelings, so I had to ask him as a third person.
I felt happy that I didn't lose her and that she was going to be okay and that my family wouldn't, be worried, all day and praying for her. But I felt really good that she's still alive.
That's a new voice and responding in the third person. Very interesting.
Yeah, and you can hear the rest of that story if you go to our website. It's kuow.org/radioactive, and that's also where you can find applications to apply for the next workshop.
But you had a couple more clips.
Yeah, so this next story is by Evan Adams, who is also part of our fall workshop at South Park. And he is a junior at Garfield High School in Seattle. And like many high school juniors, he is stressing about taking the SAT. He wants to go to the college of his dreams, and that's the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. But MIT requires high SAT scores, and Evan struggles with taking tests. So we're going to listen to a clip from his story where he describes what it's like for him to take a test.
At my high school, they have a mandatory practice SAT that every junior must take.
This section contains two types of math questions. Questions 21 to 28 are multiple choice, just like usual.
It's a three-hour test. The whole time I'm taking the test, I'm hoping to God that I put down the right answers. The PSET is important to me. It determines if I can get a National Merit Scholarship. When I'm taking the test, it's pure silence. That's where I start to freak out a little bit. Whenever I'm sitting down for long periods of time, I start to get really anxious, and that makes it hard for me to take the test.
We're going to skip ahead in the story. And now Evan is deciding to find out what his chances are at his dream school, MIT.
I contacted MIT because I wanted to hear what they said about my situation. I wanted to see if it was still a possibility for me to go there, even though I was a bad test taker. I talked to Matt McGann. He's the director of admissions at MIT. And he said,
"We know that students have different strengths, and sometimes it may be in taking exams. Other times their academic strengths may come out other places. And that's why we really want to take a holistic look at the application. that we want to consider all parts of a student's academic preparation and their college readiness. So standardized tests like the SAT or ACT, that can be one part of it. But we really want to see also, how you've done in high school. And actually, having taken challenging courses and getting good grades in high school, that's going to be the most important part of our process.
I also learned that they just don't look at your school performance. They look at your behavior outside of school, too. Now I feel more at ease because I feel like a 1,000-pound brick just got lifted off my shoulders, and I can breathe a lot easier. For Radioactive, I'm Evan Adams.
So did Evan felt better? He stayed feeling better?
Yeah, I mean, one of the cool things for young people who do this program is getting to learn that I could call up the admissions director at MIT and ask them what my chances are for going to MIT. And I think that power that people get when they step into those shoes as a journalist, it's great. And yeah, it was a huge relief for Evan to learn that the SATs weren't the only thing that MIT was looking at.
Jenny Asano runs our Radioactive program for high school students who want to learn about telling stories through sound. We're going to have another session February 12th through April 11th at the Treehouse Building. That's in 2100 Rainier Avenue in partnership with Rainier Scholars. So one last little taste of a story here.
Okay, let's listen to the beginning of a story by Radioactive youth producer Antonia Dorn, and it's introduced here by Radioactive's Anne Kane.
Maga Brazio Sockham Tickham is 16 years old. She helps the kids suffering with cancer at Seattle Children's Hospital. But the help goes both ways. Maga's been suffering with leukemia herself since she was 15. Radioactive's Antonia Dorn has more.
Maga Brazio Sockham Tickham is a protector. She's also my best friend. I used to be scared of getting cancer because my dad died from tongue cancer. Maga told me she'd protect me from getting sick.
If you got cancer or anything, I would take it away from you because I wouldn't let you go through that because I saw how afraid you were and I just knew that I wouldn't let it happen.
Maga and I got close from playing around at daycare. She was always really active. She'd do anything that let her run, especially play soccer. Then, one day, she had felt weak and had to lean on a bus stop near her school. She had a rare form of leukemia at 15 years old. In one day, she went from being a soccer player to being in bed all day.
To hear the rest of that story, go to kuow.org/radioactive. And that's also where you can find applications for our upcoming fall workshop, again, in partnership with Rainier Scholars. It's free. No experience is required. And we're taking applications now. They're due on January 21st.
Winter workshop. You must call it the winter workshop.
We're calling it our spring workshop.
Oh, okay. Your spring workshop. Okay.
It straddles end of winter and beginning of spring.
That makes sense. All right. All right. Good. Good. Thank you, Jenny.
Thanks for having me.
Sign up. You could be sitting in the chair. This is Weekday.
And now, the sound of the day.
That's the sound of empty bottles going down a bottling line where they're washed out and filled with tequila. Then a worker places the metal cap on the bottle, which is then squeezed into place by the machine you hear making the puffing air sound. And once the caps are secure, the bottles move farther down the line to be hand-labeled and boxed up. Weekday listener Sven recorded that sound while on a visit to Tequila, Mexico, where he works with Black Rock Spirits, a Seattle-based company that just started importing their own tequila into Washington. Thought it was fun to hear the clinking of the bottles and the machinery working. He says the clinking glass sounds almost festive, has a holiday feel to it. But then again, he says, I suppose drinking tequila is usually festive, or turns into a party anyways. What interesting sounds are you hearing? Record 30 seconds of your life in sound. Send it to us along with the story behind it. Email it to weekday@kuow.org with sound of the day in the subject line. Now, you might be thinking you're either going to hear stressful traffic or the nice, quiet ka-chunk of snowshoes or skis in snow. Michael Fagan is with West Coast Weather, LLC. He blogs about it and shares information about it. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Steve.
So you have a hike for us to go with the weather forecast.
That's right. Well, actually, we have a ski. I know some people in Olympia and Bellevue were ready to strap on their skis this morning. Some areas had an inch and a half of snow. We are expecting chances of some light snow showers this afternoon, but best chance of those showers will be north and south of Seattle and at elevations at 500 feet or above. Now, our trip for this week is at Mount Rainier Park, West Side Road, and there's several things I like about this. It's just a mile past the park entrance, and do remember that you cannot get up to Paradise. The roads close on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, except during Christmas break or if there's heavy snow. However, our trip, you don't need to go to Paradise. Again, it's just a mile outside of the entrance, and basically you start off, well, I talked to the ranger on Sunday, and they said you probably need to carry your skis for the first half mile. Well, they just got some new snow yesterday and today, so you could put your skis or snowshoes on right from the get-go. This is very gradual. If you're a beginner skier, this is really good. It's just a 1,000-foot elevation gain in 3 miles, and we do want to mention that you should not go beyond the 3 mile mark, because you can run into some avalanche issues beyond that. But if you stay within the 3 miles, it's nice and flat and gentle. You're not going to get any views of Rainier on the road, and given the weather that we currently have, it's going to be cloudy, so that's not an issue. There's some nice views of several creeks, some wildlife, and the best day to go will probably be Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. It'll be relatively better than what we're going to see on Wednesday and Thursday, because we're looking at some heavy rain and or snow in the mountains on Wednesday and Thursday. And this is Green Trail Map 269S, and you'll need a park pass to enter into the Mount Rainier Park.
Heavy rain or snow, is it possible some of the snow will get rained on at this elevation?
Well, that's going to be tricky for our trip. It's going to be right on the cusp. So, you know, on Wednesday and Thursday, you know, the problem actually on Wednesday is driving to the park, because some of the areas you might have to be dealing with driving in snow. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend Wednesday or Thursday. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the weather will be better. It might, and again, we'll be on the cusp for the trip, whether it's going to be rain or rain mixed with snow. But any of the showers Friday through Sunday will be lighter. So, again, that'll be a little bit better than Wednesday or Thursday.
And today looks like kind of a transition day, a 50% chance of rain or rain mixed with snow. But what do the mountains look like today?
Snoqualmie Pass and Stevens Pass, they'll be getting another 5-6 inches of snow, but lighter amounts of snow. So if you are, if you do want to head up to the pass, you need to be aware there are some avalanche issues. So staying at the ski areas is probably the best if you're going to be doing that. So today is actually lighter showers in the mountains as opposed to Wednesday and Thursday.
All right. So maybe also we'll just walk around our city parks.
Maybe just go to the mall and get some shopping done.
Yeah, there you go. All right, Michael.
City park.
Yeah, the city park. All right, Michael, thank you.
Sure.
Michael Fagan joins us every Tuesday to give us a hike to go along with a weather forecast. You can find a link, hikewashington.net. It's his new website. There you'll find some pretty amazing pictures, including a lovely picture that Karen Sykes took of a grouse. Must have walked right up below her feet for her to get that sort of perspective. That's at hikewashington.net. Stay with us. We're going to talk about gun control. We're going to talk about what the city council might ask of the legislature and what some gun advocates might say about the new calls for some gun control. Also, holiday drinks around the world. It's not just eggnog. There's some interesting and strange things. And we'll talk with some of you about what you're saying to your kids and what you think about the news of these past few days. That's all coming up. Stay with us.
It's a minute before 10. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away. This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from World Vision, committed to helping children in need achieve a full life by creating real and lasting change in more than 90 countries worldwide. World Vision believes in children.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.